Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 125, I continue my discussion with Gene Dolgoff about 3D perception and the holographic brain. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 17th, 2012, episode 125, The Holographic Brain. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week, we're having back as our special guest for part two of a very interesting discussion, Gene Dolgoff, who is developing a 3D technology that we talked about last week and how you can, in fact, get in on the action and submit a design for the case. We'll reiterate some of that. But today we're going to be getting more deeply into brain science and how the brain processes information with regard to 3D. Should be absolutely fascinating. Hey, Gene, thanks so much for coming back.
Hi, boy. It's a pleasure. What is this now, number five or six that I'm on here?
I think this is number five. You are, in fact, now officially the most returned, the guest with the most returns on the show, and rightly so, because an awful lot of people in the chat room and emailing me various times have said, wow, that guy's amazing, and I couldn't agree more. So let's get into it. Let's start by reiterating just briefly what we talked about last week in terms of this project that you're doing and how people can get involved.
Right. We have developed this new incredible box called the Instant 3D Converter, and we're going to make this product available to the public. So this is a device that you hook up to your TV at home, whatever TV you've got. It doesn't matter if it's an old CRT or it's an LCD or it's a plasma or a laser or a DLP, and it turns it into a 3D TV automatically. And plus, the input to this box can be absolutely any video stream whatsoever. So it can be satellite, cable, DVD, Blu-ray, camcorder, game system. It converts all your game systems and all your games to 3D. So this is a way for only $299, which is going to be the retail price, to have a full 3D capability at home. And we are making this available through a site called Fundable.com, which you see down on the bottom of the screen there. And we are taking pre-orders at half the price that it's actually going to sell for. And we're holding a contest. We need somebody to give us a great design for the outside of the box. And if we get a good design from somebody, we will give them $10,000. So could be you.
Holy smokes. Well, it couldn't be me. But it could be somebody out there in the audience. Absolutely.
Yeah, just draw something.
Yeah, exactly. You could be on the back of an envelope, or it could be a CAD drawing, any level of sophistication that you want. Basically, you would go to this site, fundable.com/3DVision, which is your page. And this is a crowdfunding site, somewhat like Kickstarter, where people pledge a certain amount of money and in order to fund a particular project. And in this case, what you're funding is the prize money to give to the winning designer who submits a design that you accept. And I see, in fact, as we're looking at the site, that you've, in fact, exceeded your goal already. And there's still 17 days left in the fundable project.
Right. Well, that's because people can pre-order the product for $149, even though it's going to retail for $299.
Only for the first 100 people. And the pre-order counts though. Towards the funding.
Right. Right.
Gotcha.
So, hurry up and go to that site after the show is over and tell all your friends to go there as well.
Exactly.
So what we're going to talk about today is the real heart of how this thing actually works, because it does create incredible 3D, and it does it in a way that's different than any other 3D conversion has ever done it before. It's a completely new technology based on a completely new understanding of the brain, which is based on my work.
Exactly. And we're going to get deeply into that. But I wanted to just mention real quick that, you know, most 3D TVs have a 2D to 3D conversion in them. And I have, in all the ones I've seen, I have been, let us say, underwhelmed.
So is everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. So give us the lowdown on what you're doing and how it makes a more effective presentation.
Our box, first of all, compares frames at a time, and it looks for things like changes in brightness, contrast, resolution or sharpness, and it looks for changes in the position in the frame. It looks for changes in size, color saturation. All of these things change with depth, and especially motion. The further away something is, the slower it moves. Mm-hmm. So all these factors give our algorithm data to tell where a lot of things in the scene actually is, even though we're just looking at a 2D video. The fact is there's 3D information in 2D video. But it's only go ahead.
I was going to say, that actually makes some sense. Leo Laporte and I often talk about 3D, and we have somewhat of a differing opinion about it. He doesn't like it as much as I do, but he does make the point, and I agree with him, that when you look at a very high resolution image, we talk particularly about 4K, which is coming around the pike, that it almost has a three-dimensional character to it, which lends credence to exactly what you're saying.
That's right, because that's what the brain is doing, and that's what the system is based on, which we're going to get into in a minute. And mm-hmm. So even though this does get 3D information from the 2D video, it only can get it from a certain percentage of the scene, and there are lots of areas where it can't tell. So what our system does is it creates 3D data that's real on the screen, and then lots of malleable 2D data. Fungible 2D data, which your brain can then turn into 3D data, which is why the whole picture looks like really good 3D. And that's what I'm going to explain today, is how the brain does that. That's the exciting.
All ears and all eyes.
Okay, wow. Okay, so we're going to have to go over some scientific principles. And so I'm going to go over them quickly, but I'm going to make them easy to understand. It's a lot of data coming at you, but then what you'll have to do is watch the show a few times, and then you'll get it, because it's not too complicated to understand. It's just a lot. So
the points that
we're going to cover are the following. Fourier transform. You're going to learn what the heck that is. And holography.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about where did I put that? Where did I put the list of what we're covering? Okay.
Interference, certainly, which is part of the holography.
Right. And also autocorrelation. So these are all different concepts that are part of this understanding. So let's start. The question is, how does the brain store and retrieve data and experiences without any software that somebody has programmed in beforehand? I mean, we can program a computer to do those things, but nobody's programmed this computer to do it. So how does it accomplish this? So what you really need is a simple, reversible, automatic process that has to be able to evolve naturally. It's got to be able to do all this naturally, and it's got to be reversible. So you'll see what I mean by that. So let's first talk about interference. What is interference? Well, everything in the universe comes in waves. Everything is made of waves. And waves are just changes that propagate. So, for instance, you know, the people stand up in the stadium one after another. They do the wave. Mm-hmm. That's a wave. Or you drop a rock in water, and then you got water waves. And anything that causes a change over space, or even over time, but let's just talk about space now, is a wave, because it happens here, then it happens there, then it happens there. So it's a traveling wave of change of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say there are two waves that are meeting or overlapping in the same area of space. What happens? Well, the truth is they do not affect each other. Everybody is thinking, well, the waves will affect each other. They don't. They have no effect on each other whatsoever.
They just pass right through each other, essentially.
That's it. But the illusion is that they interact with each other. So I'll give you a perfect example. Let's say you drop a rock in the water and you see some waves spreading out in the water. And there's a cork floating on the water. Now you drop two rocks in the water. By the way, when you do one rock, you see the cork going up and down.
Right.
Because
right.
the wave passes under it and moves the water up and down. Now you drop the two rocks in the water, and the two waves are now going to meet and overlap, and perhaps one wave will be the water going up, while the other wave is the water going down. And when they meet, the net result is the water doesn't go anywhere. So
right.
now the cork doesn't move. Now you say, wait a minute. I dropped the rocks and the waves were going. How come the water is still over there? How come it's not going anywhere? Well, that's called interference. And it's referred to as destructive interference because the waves appear to be canceling each other out.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to draw something on the board here or the paper to show you what that looks like with waves.
So here we've those of you who are only listening can I'll describe what he's doing here a little bit. He's got a pad of paper and he is drawing a wave. Looks so like sort of a sine wave.
Right. And it's going, let's say, in this direction,
mm-hmm.
to the right. Now a
to
second
right.
wave comes in, let's say, and this wave is going oppositely, which is called out of phase. And
right.
this
so
wave,
in other words, its crest, its top, the top part of its wave, it coincides with the bottom part of the other wave and vice versa.
Exactly. So now you see, if these two waves were happening at the same time, well, according to the first wave, the water would have to go down and make a trough. But according to the second wave, the wave would have to go up and make a crest. So the water can't do two things at the same time. So what it does instead is it stays flat. It does nothing. It's a crazy thing. This is called destructive interference.
And in fact, it's the basis of noise, active noise-canceling headphones.
That's right. That's right.
Because the noise-canceling headphones take in a sound, better for it to be a steady-state sound, like engine noise, and they generate another wave that's completely out of phase with it, add it together, and you get destructive interference. It's not perfect. You still hear some of the sound, but it's a lot lower in amplitude than the original sound. So that's another example of what we're talking about here.
Right. Now, another situation might be one wave, as we drew before, goes in one direction, and then another wave coming from the other direction, but it could be in phase with it. So here's the other wave, and you see it's sort of doing the same thing, just going in the opposite direction.
The troughs and the crests coincide. They're the same in the same location.
And the result is now, if this is water, the water just adds these two together. So now you get a much bigger movement of the water, and that bigger movement is the sum of those two waves. So again, if there was a cork floating, it would really be moving up and down a lot now. So the cork tells you those waves are both interacting with the cork, but the waves are not interacting with each other. But the illusion is that they are.
Right. And this, by the way, as opposed to the other kind, which is destructive interference, this is called constructive interference.
Exactly what I was going to say. Thank you for saying that.
Sorry.
No, that's good. So now, because you see, I drew these two waves going in opposite directions. Well, what will happen is these waves will stay there. Even as the waves continue to move in opposite directions, these apparent big waves or this apparent wave will stay there. So even though the waves are continuing to move through this area, the water will appear stationary, either in this flat position if they're out of phase or in this big wave position if they're in phase. Because they're coming from opposite directions, it causes what's called a standing wave. So this standing wave just seems to stay still right there. And that's a very important concept, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes to see why that's so important. Okay, so that's the interference of waves. Now, let's talk about a Fourier transform. Sounds pretty complicated, especially because Fourier is a French name, so we're not used to that kind of sound. But anyway.
And it is named after a guy named Fourier, right?
That's right. Jean-Joseph Fourier in 1807 did this incredible work. And what he said was, any complex wave can be broken down to a series of sine waves that just differ in terms of how high they are, their amplitude, and their phase relationship. So,
and their frequency.
Their frequency. You're absolutely right. So now I'm going to just show you an example of that. And we'll take a quick look at that. Here we have a complicated wave.
A complex waveform.
Yeah, it's a very complicated thing. But if we use the mathematical equation called the Fourier transform, it can be broken down into a series of sine waves. So here's one, here's another one, and here's another one, and so on. And you just need a series of sine waves which have the right frequency, the right phase, and the right strength or amplitude, and they add them all up together, and they will add up to this complicated wave.
I've always found that very fascinating myself, that you can take any arbitrarily complex wave and break it down into a combination of sine waves, and they're exactly, completely, identically equivalent. You can't tell the difference whether you've added a bunch of them together or just generated that complex wave to begin with. It's fascinating.
It is amazing. And here's what can be done in optics. If you simply take, let me draw this for you. If you take a light source and you have it go towards a lens, well, you know that the lens will come to a focus somewhere. And of course, after that, it spreads out again and it makes an image over here of whatever was the original image source. Mm-hmm. But this point here, where the focus is of the lens, happens to be a Fourier transform of whatever the original image is. So if you
really?
Had some.
Oh, that I didn't know.
If you had some kind of an image here of something and you put a lens there, at the focal point of that lens, you get a Fourier transform of that image. And that Fourier transform takes that image and reorganizes it into a polar coordinate pattern. So let me give you an idea.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by a polar coordinate pattern?
Right. Let me explain that to you. Let's say that you have an image of pebbles, different size pebbles. So this image here is a picture of your driveway, and you got different size pebbles here. Big ones and small ones and medium ones and so on. So can you see all those different pebbles there?
Uh-huh, sure.
Okay, now, these images are, let's say, a transparency, a photographic transparency right over here. And you have the light coming through it, and the light goes through these holes, which are the pictures of the pebbles, and it spreads out. The different size pebbles is going to spread the light out differently because of what's called diffraction. So light diffracts through these holes differently depending on the size. Smaller pebbles or smaller holes will cause the light to spread out more. Bigger holes Right. will cause the light to spread out less. So Right. when the lens focuses everything at this focal point, what's going to happen is the light that pretty much was parallel, in other words, didn't diffract much because it came through the really big pebbles, that's going to be focused right here to this point. Mm-hmm. But the light that came from smaller pebbles won't be able to quite focus there, so it'll focus at a larger radius. So here's let's take a picture of what this looks like, what this plane looks like right here. What you're going to wind up having is a series of concentric circles. And these circles are containing information from those pebbles. So the big pebbles are going to have all their information right in the center. Mm-hmm. Smaller pebbles a little further, smaller, the tiniest of pebbles will be spreading its information around here. So this is what I mean by polar coordinates. It starts in the center and it goes outwards. So what this is called is spatial frequency. The different pebbles have different size, so they take up a different amount of space. So how frequently you could fit the pebble in depends on its size. If it's a very small pebble, then you could fit a lot of them into the same space as a big pebble. Big pebble, mm-hmm. you wouldn't fit many. So the frequency of small pebbles is high. That's therefore called a high spatial frequency. The pebbles that are real big would not fit many in. So not many of them fitting in means a low number of pebbles and therefore a low spatial frequency.
This reminds me very much of when we talk about detail in a television or a video display, the fine detail, that is the smaller objects, need a higher frequency of operation in the display in order to be displayed correctly. And we sometimes test with test patterns the performance of a TV at its highest possible frequency. And so what you're saying is much the same thing.
It is exactly the same. So the high spatial frequencies correspond to the finest detail. So what we're getting now is a remapping of this image into this image. Here we had different size pebbles laid out seemingly randomly in this picture, and now it's transformed into circles which are very specifically laid out with the data from the biggest pebbles in the center and the data from the tiniest pebbles on the outside and everything in between depending on the size of the pebble.
Now let me ask you this before we go on. That you said that the pebbles are more or less randomly laid out. How
right.
How do they get transformed into concentric circles? I would think that the circles at the focal plane, which is what you were talking about, would correspond more or less to the position of the pebbles in the original image.
It doesn't. In the Fourier transform, it just matters what the size of the pebble is in terms of what radius it appears at in the Fourier transform.
Its XY coordinate position within...
In fact, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's one of the key points that I wanted to bring up. This property of the Fourier transform is called spatial translational invariance. That means no matter how you move the pebble around in the image, it will not move around in the Fourier transform. It'll stay invariant. It'll stay right where it is. The layout is fixed. And that's an amazing thing about a Fourier transform. However, one other thing, though, if these were not round pebbles, if these were oddly shaped pebbles, and let's say they were oblong like that, now the orientation of that pebble will make a difference in what the particular layout is in the Fourier transform, because a pebble that's at one angle will skew the circle a little bit, and at a different angle, it'll skew it a little bit differently. So there is a sensitivity to angular orientation, which will change the Fourier transform, but
now,
not
the Fourier, if the,
translational.
Wait, if the Fourier transform, though, if the pebble is not circular, if it's oval, say, will the Fourier transform still be circular?
It will. The data will be spread in a circle, but within that circle, there will be a structure which will have an orientation corresponding to the angle of the pebble.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it's like a modulation of a one frequency on top of another frequency. That's what you're looking at here. So you'll see some kind of a shape on the circle itself. The circles will still be there, but there'll be an orientation. So that's the second interesting property of a Fourier transform. It is angularly selective. That angle of the original image will affect the pattern in the Fourier transform. Now, these two properties are the ones I wanted to point out because it's very important. I'm going to bring that up in just a few minutes. So just remember, those two are hallmark properties of a Fourier transform. Spatial translational invariance, doesn't matter where you move it around in the image area, the Fourier transform location stays the same, at same radius. Mm-hmm. And there is sensitivity to angle. That'll change the structure within any particular circle.
Got it.
So that was key points. Okay.
Got it.
So now, now that we have that clue, these are all clues that are going to add up to a surprise. at the end. Okay. So now, what we can do is this. Let's say we put a piece of cardboard here that has
at
a hole
in it. At the focal point of the lens.
Exactly. And there's a hole in it. Well, what's coming through the hole now, look at this picture, is the central information. Because remember what I said, after the lens passes through the focal point, it then gets an image here at 2F of the lens. And this image is the same as the original image. So you take
only,
an image.
Only inverted, I think, right?
Of course. It's inverted. It's upside down and left to right reversed, of course. But the point is, it's the same image. However, right, if you put this cardboard here, which now blocks the outer rings, well, remember the outer rings corresponded to the high spatial frequencies or the image of the small pebbles. So right. Now what you're going to get here on the final image is as the same image minus the small pebbles. Now you'll see the big pebbles, but not the small ones. They'll disappear.
Huh.
And in fact, instead of just putting a cardboard here with a hole in the middle, what if you put a cardboard here that like this, which had just a hole like this? This is the hole over here. It's a ring.
Oh, okay. So it's a solid piece of cardboard, and it just has a thin cutout, a circular cutout.
Now, if you put that here at the Fourier plane, you're going to eliminate from the final image all the images of the middle-sized pebbles. You know, depending on the radius that you allow through, that's going to determine what light can come through and what light can't come through. So I'm sorry, I said it backwards. So if this is opaque, then the light that corresponds to those pebbles will be blocked, and so those pebbles will be missing. And all the rest of the light that comes through from the middle and from the outside, those will make images of the pebbles again. So the light from the center makes the big pebbles, the light from the outside makes the small pebbles, but the light here being blocked is the medium-sized pebbles, and now they can't come through. So
let me just clarify one point here. Instead of being a piece of cardboard, now we're talking about a piece of clear glass or clear plexiglass that's letting all the light through.
Or a transparency, right?
A transparency, and you've put up a circular piece of tape that's a certain radius, a certain size, and has a certain dimension to it, small. It's a thin circular line. Maybe that's the name of a movie. and that's blocking the
certain spatial frequency.
Certain spatial frequency. And depending on the size of that circle, you can either block the smallest pebbles or the medium-sized pebbles or the biggest pebbles from appearing in the final image.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. This is called Fourier filtering. By selecting what frequencies you're filtering out in this pattern, you can then selectively eliminate certain features from the image when you re-image it. So this is an amazing thing, because actually what's happening is this lens is doing a Fourier transform, but then what's happening is the light spreads out and forms another Fourier transform. Actually, if you leave light alone once it comes out of an image, it'll form a Fourier transform naturally. It just takes a long distance. With the lens, it just does it a lot quicker and a lot shorter distance. But light naturally forms a Fourier transform as it travels. And that's one of the keys to our brains being able to do something without a programmer, is it naturally forms, energy naturally forms a Fourier transform, naturally, without anybody programming it.
Does that work with? I would think that would work with, say, stars, because those are very far away.
Right.
But they're only little points of light. How does that become? How does that translate into a Fourier transform?
Just as the light propagates, it changes its layout so that it becomes a Fourier transform. It just naturally, light does that by interference when it overlaps each other and it spreads out.
Okay.
So this is Fourier filtering. So now, what we're saying is the Fourier transform of an image is some kind of a radial map of data. And then the Fourier transform of that is the image again. So this is a two-step reversible process, this Fourier transform. You do it once, and it creates this pattern. You do it a second time, and it goes back to the original image again. This is really important because this way the brain can form a Fourier transform and then by doing the same process again, form the image again without having to have a whole new plan, a whole new program, a whole new complicated thing to do. Mm-hmm. That's very, very important. Okay, so what we've just shown is by Fourier filtering, you can do a selection of data and only look at certain things and ignore the rest. And that's something that our brain is good at, ignoring things.
Yes, it is.
And this, it's done by Fourier filtering. Okay, so also what we're seeing is that if you take a Fourier transform and then you shine light through it, it becomes another Fourier transform of that, and you create an image. Now, this led to a very brilliant invention. And this was by a guy named Sir Lawrence Bragg in 1929. He had a crystal, and that crystal was called diopside, and it has a structure in it of atoms. And he wanted to see what the atom structure was like. And so he put X-rays through that crystal, and the X-rays hit the atoms in the crystal and scattered and diffracted and made some kind of an interesting pattern that was recorded on film. So you had a pattern of dots on film from the X-rays scattering out of the crystal. Now, what he did with that next is incredible. He took that pattern and he analyzed it by doing a Fourier transform. And what he got is, remember, you take a complex wave and you turn it into a series of sine waves.
Yep.
Well, he
yep.
calculated 40 different sine waves from that. Now, these 40 different sine waves were just, each of them was a sine wave, but they only differed in what's the frequency of it, you know, how fast was it going, what's the phase of it, and how strong was it. By calculating those 40 different sine waves, he then said, okay, I'm going to put them together optically and see if I can get an image of the atomic structure of this crystal. So what he did is...
That is cool.
It is. Here's how he did it. He laid down some cylinders that are like cylindrical rods, equally spaced, and the spacing of the cylinders was determined by the frequency that the sine waves were supposed to be at. So each one was a different frequency. So he would lay down a series of cylinders on the floor, take a picture of it. Now he'd rearrange them at a different spacing and a different phase relationship, take another picture of it. He did this for 40 different sine waves. Then what he did is he put a piece of film up on a screen and he projected each of the 40 images one at a time onto this piece of film so they would superimpose the images of those cylinders, which the cylinders looked like a sine wave. When he finished superimposing those 40 images, what he got was a picture of the atomic structure of that crystal. Actual magnified image by a factor of the difference in the wavelength between the X-rays and the light he was looking at it.
Which is
a lot. A big difference. That's why it blew up. And you could see the atoms on the picture just by the Fourier transform again. And when you put an image together by a Fourier transform, it's called Fourier synthesis. So, and he won a Nobel Prize. I mean, this was a really brilliant idea.
And I have to say, it's also, I also use it it is used quite a bit in electronic music, Fourier synthesis, wherein you take a bunch of sine waves and you add them together to create complex sound waveforms, also called additive synthesis. So this is another example in the audio world of what you're talking about.
Exactly right. So this synthesis technique is due to interference. All the waves are interfering with each other and creating a new pattern. So that was a very important part of understanding how the brain works, as you'll see in a minute. Now, everything is therefore interference patterns, and standing waves produce interference patterns that stay stationary. So that
right.
means if you analyze any particular image into a series of sine waves. Now, get this experiment. This is cool. You take, let's say, a stick, and you hit the water with it repeatedly. You keep hitting the water with it. If you do it at the right time, you can get a series of waves that that just keep going. Now, you on the other side of the pool, you put another stick and you hit the water also. Now you get another series of waves. Now these waves overlap, like I drew before, and you get standing waves. Okay, now, that's with two sticks. Now, what if you do it with more sticks, and you do it all in a circle? If you do this, and you calculate the Fourier series of sine waves that you need to represent a particular image, and you have all these sine waves together adding up, you can create an image of anything. And this was done in Japan. Now, put on that standing wave slide.
Yeah, we have a graphic here that illustrates exactly this point. And while John's getting it, I will tell you, there it is. I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay, so now what you see in a circle here are all these electromagnets, like solenoids, which are just beating on the water at the right phase, at the right time.
So in other words, we're looking at a circular pool of water here, a shallow pool of water.
Right, and by them beating on each other, and beating on the water, I mean, at the right time, they're creating waves in the water, which all add up to a standing wave pattern. They wanted to create the letter S elevated above the water. And as you see here, the water just generated this letter S, and it just sits there. It's an amazing thing.
That's amazing.
Just by all these actuators banging on the water all the way around it, they all add up to the letter S, because that's what the Fourier transform was calculated from. And that S now exists on the water as a physical thing, a physical object.
While the rest of the water is pretty stationary.
Yeah, it looks stationary, and yet it's got waves going through it, but those are canceling each other by destructive interference.
Mm-hmm. Until you get to the part of the S, in which case there's some constructive interference, but again, it's a standing wave, so it remains stationary. Fascinating.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, think about this in relation, by the way, to matter. Matter is the sum of waves interfering, and they are standing waves. So this is part of my matter hologram theory, which led to the holodeck. The interference pattern of energy that leads to subatomic particles adds up to, through standing waves, to the appearance of objects, and that's what matter is.
Right.
It's not real. It's just a standing wave pattern.
Right, exactly right. We should tell everybody, by the way, that in your conversations with Gene Roddenberry way back when, you were the guy who said to him, suggested the whole idea of the holodeck, which is now an integral part of the Star Trek lore.
Right. Once I understood this theory of holography and applied it to interference with waves of any kind, I realized matter is also a holographically created by interference phenomena. And so then I realized, wait, we can have matter holograms. You put energy through a hologram, generate the right pattern, and it will have substance to it. And I explained this to Gene Roddenberry, and I said, therefore, we're going to have replicators, we're going to have teleportation, and we're going to have entertainment centers like the holodeck. And after I showed him holograms and explained it to him, he got it, and he included it in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Right.
It was 1973 that I explained that to him, by the way.
Incredible. Listen, there's so much more to go, but before we do, I do have to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Who knows? Someday Netflix might have holographic streaming into your home with interference patterns and Fourier synthesis. But for now, you can certainly get it by means of your internet connection and find thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed directly to your home and displayed on your TV or your computer, your smartphone, your tablet, just about any display device. And using as a source just about any consumer electronics device. TVs have the Netflix app. Computers certainly do. Tablets, smartphones, gaming consoles, Blu-ray players. Just about anything you can imagine will get you to Netflix right away for one low monthly fee, a subscription fee for as much content as you can possibly consume. You can even start on one device and finish on another, so it's the ultimate in flexibility. For a 30-day free trial, go to netflix.com/twit. I know that most of you listening and watching this show probably already have Netflix, but for those few who don't, I do recommend it. I use it all the time. That's netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWIT network. So, Gene Dolgoff is explaining some amazing stuff to us about how waves interact with each other to create holograms, or at least to create standing waves. I think holograms are next, right?
It's coming up. But now, what I wanted to say to finish off what we were just talking about is what we showed with the pebbles is different size pebbles, which on an image is different spatial frequencies, are viewed separately in a Fourier transform. It appears at different radii on the transform. So you can have the information corresponding to certain size pebbles separated from the information on other size pebbles. That means different information can have different spatial frequencies. So what we have to show you now is two pictures superimposed on one another, where one picture is done with low spatial frequencies and one is done with high spatial frequencies. And in fact, the difference in spatial frequencies is so great that your brain cannot see all these spatial frequencies at the same time. So put on that Einstein picture.
There it is.
Now, look closely at the screen. Come right up to the screen as close as you can and look at this picture of Einstein. Now, that's done with high spatial frequencies, and you can see Einstein very well. And those high spatial frequencies are perceived by you as a picture of Einstein, and you don't see anything else. Now, move back up 10 feet from the screen, and maybe 15 feet, and you will be shocked. No, keep the picture up. You will be shocked to see that Einstein totally disappears, and there is Marilyn Monroe. How the heck did that happen?
I have seen that, and I don't understand.
Marilyn Monroe's picture was done with different spatial frequencies, low spatial frequencies.
Does that mean the details in her picture are lower resolution than the details in the Einstein picture?
Yes, that's right. But when you move further back, all that stuff gets smaller. The screen gets smaller and all the details on the screen get smaller. So now the details of Marilyn Monroe now falls into the spatial frequency range that you can see. And the Einstein information now goes way beyond the information, the size that you can see. So
at
you can't see both. Right. You can't see both at the same time at one of these two distances.
Right.
The spatial frequencies are different that make up the two pictures. It's an amazing thing to look at that picture.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It's a little bit creepy at a medium distance because they're sort of both there.
That's right. Marilyn Einstein. There you go.
There you go.
So, okay.
Or Albert Monroe.
Now, here's the thing that I realized. In 1959, there were two researchers, Hubel and Wiesel. And these guys were doing groundbreaking work in psychology. And what they did is they took, for instance, an anesthetized cat, and they stuck electrodes into the striate visual cortex of the cat. And they would show the cat little images of light. And they would then move the light to different locations in front of the cat's eye to see which cells are firing in the visual cortex of the brain, and made a map of which cells in the striate cortex in the back of the brain will fire when you have the light in different places. And they won the Nobel Prize for this, and they made a map showing that there are columns of cells in the striate cortex that behave differently at the lower level. They call this the simple cells. You pretty much got a map of what the eyes were seeing. So if the light source was here, the brain cells that would fire would be about the same location. You move it to the right, the light source to the right, the cells to the right in that layer would fire. So at that level, they call it simple cell level, the striate cortex behaved like a mirror image of what your retina saw. However, when they went higher up in the column of cells, then it no longer was a map of the retinal image. Now they saw strange phenomena, which they reported on. They didn't understand what caused it to happen, but they reported on it. So here we had a map of what happened. But what happened was this. And when I heard this, the bells went off. When they moved the light and they looked at the cells in this, what they called the complex level, the area of cells that fired did not move. It didn't matter where they moved the light, it would stay, the same cells in the cortex would light up. So there was spatial translational invariance. No matter where they moved the stimulating light in front of the cat's eye, the same cells would stay lit up and other cells stay not lit up. Then they noticed if they took a pattern of light in a line and they rotated it, that would change which cells would fire.
Oh my goodness. So in other words, the complex layer was the Fourier transform.
Yes. And what happens is, and this is what I realized, is that the columns of cells are arranged so that it forces a physical Fourier transform in a tiny space of the different layers of your brain.
Right.
So the data comes in at the simple level, and then it is turned into a Fourier transform at the complex level. And these two observations of spatial translational invariance and sensitivity to angular change made it very clear to me that that explains that strange behavior that Hubel and Wiesel had no idea why that happened. Mm. It was because it's a Fourier transform. So that
was amazing.
That was an amazing thing to realize. So that means we have Fourier transforms in our brain. We have Fourier filtering going on in our brain. Now, go to the next step. What happens if you record that Fourier image? It's an interference pattern. What if you record it on something, like a piece of film? Well, the recording of an interference pattern is called a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a hologram is. It's just simply a recording of an interference pattern. So obviously in our brain, we got lots of recordings going on because we do record the different patterns. Well, now it's not film, but what it is the growth of axons, neurons, and movement to junctions, which are called synapses. And they get recorded as a pattern of synapse connections. And that interference pattern recording is a hologram, not on film, but in neural material.
Right,
so we have neural holograms recorded in our brain, which is an amazing thing.
It is.
And
no question.
This is all stuff from the book that I'm writing on the brain. And of course, this is just a really brief summary of a little part of it. But it's amazing, mind-blowing stuff. So this holography recording is made in the brain. So now we know there are holograms recorded in the brain. So now let's look at a particular property of holograms. Now that we know there are holograms there, and this is going to lead to how our 3D converter works.
As we turn to a new page of on the giant pad, Professor Dolgoff will show us yet more wonders, I'm sure.
Okay, here we go. So basically, let's show how a hologram is made. Let's have a table here. Can you see that? Yes. Lots of different objects on here, whatever they are. You know, you got a milk carton, you got a telephone, you got a salt shaker, you got all different objects on this table here. And now we're going to take a laser beam, because lasers work best and easiest with making holograms, but it's not essentially necessary, but it makes it easier. And then we have a little, the beam is coming out of the laser, and we have a lens here to spread the beam out. So the beam lights up this table with all these objects here. And now we place a piece of film here. This is going to record the hologram so that the light coming from these objects can bounce off and go to the film. That makes sense. But now we add one more thing. We add a beam splitter, a half-silvered mirror, a piece of glass that's got a thin coating of silver on it. So it lets light through, but it also reflects light. So some of the light bounces off of that mirror and goes right to the film. This beam here is called the reference beam. It has no information about this table of objects. It's just a reference. But now here's what happens. The waves that are coming from these objects...
Reflecting
from the objects, from the laser beam, hit the film at the same time that this reference beam hits the film. These beams, therefore, meet and interfere with each other, creating standing waves just like the water did before. So that creates the interference pattern that gets recorded right here. That's basically how you make an optical hologram. Now, here's the next step. Now you've got the hologram here. Here's the hologram. And you have the laser here like you had before. And you have the lens here. And the light is spreading out. And you put the splitter here. And the light shines on the film. But you notice we no longer have the table with the objects. Well, what happens is...
Right, that got moved away.
We moved it away. Now this light that hits the hologram hits this interference pattern... And it's a Fourier transform of a Fourier transform. We get back to the original image again. So what happens is this light that comes out of the hologram is the same light that was coming off of these objects. So it looks as if the table is still here with
it's
all
still
the objects.
Back there behind the piece of film.
When you look through the film, you still see the table with all the objects, even though it's not there.
Yeah,
that's the amazing thing that a hologram does. It reconstructs the image. All you need is the reference beam. Go ahead. You had a question?
I was going to ask. That works very well for still images. What about moving images?
It's doable with moving images, too, but that's a whole other show. So
we'll table that for now, then. Okay.
So what's amazing now is this. We've just used the reference beam to play back this entire scene of objects. The light coming from these objects, by the way, is called the object beam, which makes sense. And so the reference beam plays back all the objects. Let's say there were 10 objects on the table. Now you look through the hologram, you see all 10 objects. Now, here's the amazing thing. Take away the reference beam and just shine the light on the objects. Put the table back. Now, take away all the objects and just leave one object on the table. The light from that one object will shine on this hologram and detract and play back all the other 9 objects. That's the amazing thing.
Wow. Say that again. Go through that one more time.
You block the reference beam. You don't use this splitter anymore. And instead, you put the table back. And this time you only put one of the objects on the table. The other 9 you take away. The light.
One of the objects that was there originally.
Originally there. You put it back in its original location.
Okay.
Now the hits that object, goes down to the hologram, and the light from that single object causes the hologram to play back the light that came off of the other 9 objects. So you
How
don't
is that
only.
Possible?
Because that light was there. You see, the fact is. All the light waves that were present at the same time are associated together in that interference pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So all you need is part of that light to interact with this recorded pattern to play back by diffraction all the other light rays that made up the rest of the image. So you only need part of it to play back all of it. That's the amazing thing about a hologram. All you need is one part of the information. So now think about this. You ever go someplace where you smell a strange smell and you say, wait a minute, I remember as a kid smelling this smell. Let's see, I was in my grandfather's house. Oh, and I remember they were baking these brownies. Oh, I remember what that smelled like. Oh, and I remember the color of those drapes. Oh, it was terrible. Oh, and I remember this awful breakfast. It tasted so bad. And you remember all these things just from that one smell. Why? Because holographically, all those things were recorded and all those things were associated together in a holographic recording. All you need is one of those to reconstruct all the others that were recorded in that holographic recording. Because you have all these holographic recordings in your brain already. Every set of experiences that happen at any given time become associated together as a holographic recording in the brain. Now you just need part of it to play back all of it. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing thing about holography. So now let's get the conclusion of all of this. Bring it all together.
You bet.
Since we know there are Fourier transforms in the hologram in the brain, and they get recorded, therefore they become holograms. Therefore, you have holograms in your brain, and therefore all experiences that you have become recorded as holograms. And a hologram behaves in such a way that all you need is one part of the data that was in the hologram to play back all the rest of the data that's in the hologram.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's how you're able to, just by a small input of information, come up with all these things that are associated with it. So now, back to our 2D to 3D converter. What do? We find whatever 3D information we possibly can from analyzing two frames at a time. And we put stereoscopic data on those points that we have three-dimensional information. But then when there's no certainty about it, we don't put 3D information. But the brain has holographic experiences of three-dimensional scenes like what you're looking at. So the brain then plays back the 3D on the other areas that we didn't figure out in our algorithm. So the heavy lifting is done by the brain algorithms, not by the algorithms in our box. Now, I want to show you
a couple. In fact, is why you can get away with a box that doesn't have supercomputer power, because you don't need it. All you need to do is calculate the 3D data on some of the scene that you're looking at, and the brain will fill in the rest on the rest of the scene.
Exactly. Now, I just want to show you three quick examples. So let's put up the cubes, for instance. You have that, John?
Let's see if we can find cubes. Okay. There it is.
So, if you notice on the top image, this is a cube, a three-dimensional cube, but three areas have been erased. So you have data missing. And yet, when you look at it, you still know that's a three-dimensional wire cube structure, even though data is missing. Because your brain is filling in the rest because of previously experienced data that's holographically recorded in your brain. The image on the bottom, however, has lines drawn at the edges of each segment, and that corresponds to totally different experiences in your past, and therefore you don't see the bottom image as a three-dimensional cube, but just as different shapes lying there.
Okay. So it's as if in the top one you ran an eraser diagonally in those three areas, whereas in the bottom image the figures, the lines have been completed into closed loops, and all of a sudden it doesn't look at all like a cube.
Exactly. Now let's go to the words. When you read words, all you have to do is see the beginning of the word and the end of the word, and that will reconstruct the holographic recordings of words in your brain. So you really don't need the letters in between the first and last letters of a word. So
This one before. Yeah, this one is a Word document.
Yeah, it's brain recognition. That's what it's
and
labeled.
Let's see if we can find that and show that. I have seen examples of this before where the first letter and the last letter of each word is correct, and all the letters in between aren't, and yet you can still read it and understand it. Let's see if John can find that.
John,
he doesn't have this one. Sorry, I thought I had included it in the Dropbox, but apparently not. Okay, go to the next example then. Sorry.
Next example. Unfortunate. This is in a museum, and these are 1,000 pieces of metal hanging from strings. Each piece of metal is hanging from a string attached to the ceiling. Now, you're going to look at this, and you're going to see all these 1,000 pieces of metal hanging, and I bet you have no trouble in seeing the three-dimensional image that your brain reconstructs out of it.
Yeah, it's a boat on a surface of the water with the reflection ocean of the boat in the water.
And all your brain is creating that by experience that has been holographically recorded. And all you're looking at is 1,000 pieces of metal on strings hanging from the ceiling. And yet your brain has put together an image of a boat on the water.
That's complete with the reflection of the boat in the water.
This is another proof of what I'm talking about. The holographic reconstruction just requires part of the image to reconstruct the whole thing. So this is how our amazing 2D to 3D instant converter works. And you can support our effort and pre-order one at Fundable.com.
Fundable.com/3-D Vision, which is the name of your company, 3D Vision. And you can also learn more about what Gene does at 3-DVision.com, the home website for Gene's company there. Boy, I tell you, Gene, this is quite amazing. You've blown a lot of minds in the chat room. I know that for sure because they're all saying so. And you're also right that it will behoove people to watch this show more than once to catch everything that you've been talking about. Is there anything else you want to make sure we get in here?
I think we did it. I think we fit all that amazing, complicated stuff in one show, and I'm very glad we succeeded.
Well, thanks to you so much for coming back on. I failed to mention at the beginning of the show that one of the reasons we got cut short last week is that your laptop battery died. So now you're plugged in, and it was a good thing, actually. It was fortuitous because that allowed us to come back with part two and really get into this holographic brain stuff, which I find so very fascinating, makes a lot of sense, and allows your 3D converter to operate in a way that no other one does. And I can't wait to see it. When are we going to be able to buy this product?
Well, the product should be in production in the spring. And so sometime during the year, it'll start showing up in stores, and certainly it'll be available for the holidays. So next year is going to be a big year for 3D at home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Will you be at CES?
I expect to be at CES, and we may be in other places. Right now, we're going to be making some demos. Like if you go look at the Fundable.com site, it says where we're making demos. There is a show in New York on September 5th, which is the New York Gaming Show. It's the largest gaming show in New York, and I'm one of the speakers there, and I'm going to be demonstrating this box and this technology there. So that's going to be pretty exciting.
Fantastic. Well, I hope people who see and hear this show before then, if you're in the New York area, by all means, go check it out. I think people can make an appointment and come see you in your office, too, if they want, right?
Absolutely right. All you got to do is email us and request a date that you want to come to the office here in Westbury, Long Island, New York, and see this thing live. You can watch incredible video games in 3D on a crappy old CRT television, as well as a beautiful 3D television, and still see amazing 3D and old movies and TV shows. Oh, there you go. That's from our website there, talking about the conference. So, yeah, feel free to contact us, but please go to the website and support us and pre-order one of these things.
Inet in the chat room is asking, 3D from 2D screen? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Any TV.
Any TV at all.
Okay, so Gene.
Are there chat room questions now? Is that something that they want to do?
Well, we didn't. Well, there was one question here at the end. Jason Tech asked, why do most holograms have the RGB color and not full color information? And I would take that further. I mean, a lot of the holograms I see, and in fact, that I created as a physics student, were monochrome. They were just one color of laser.
That's very true.
How do you get a full color hologram?
Well, I did invent full color holography back in the early 70s, and there are very few full color holograms in existence. They are done. There are some color holograms that are done by what's called reflection holography. And there are a bunch of people doing that, and it requires an expensive, thick emulsion that allows you to reflect all the different wavelengths and create 3D images from each one simultaneously. But the color holography that I invented is a whole different thing, and it doesn't require a thick emulsion, and therefore it can be printed the same way a hologram is printed on a credit card, just by one impression. And it still creates full color. But it's not true that most holograms are RGB. The fact is that most holograms are just rainbow holograms. And as you move it, it goes through the rainbow of colors.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which is like a diffraction pattern.
Maybe the R, G, and B sort of stand out in that rainbow. And that's what that person is seeing.
Right. Inet asks, what is your main area of research? I guess we've been talking about it, haven't we?
Yeah, I guess I'm most involved in research in interference patterns and what's produced by that. But I think right now I've been concentrating a lot on 3D perception and television. So I guess that's been my main area of research lately.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank Spy Punch in the chat room, who says it's nice to watch someone interview someone like that who has great questions and follow-up. I appreciate that very much. This is an area of particular interest to me personally, something I studied in college as a physics student and continue to be very interested in. So this is definitely my cup of tea. Oh, when is Web3784 is asking, when is the book coming out?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that one. The question is, when will I finish writing it?
Yes. And it's not so like you don't have anything else to do.
Right. It's so hard to find the time to finish writing it. I'm slowly doing it. I've been working on it since August 2005.
Oh, man.
It's slowly coming along. Yeah. Very hard to find time.
Well, Gene, thank you so much for coming on again. You are one very popular guest, and I'm always happy to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. So again, you can go to fundable.com/3-dvision to see Gene's Fundable page and pre-order this 2D to 3D converter, and perhaps even submit your own design for the industrial design, the case that's going to go around it. Maybe pick yourself up 10 grand. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and I always appreciate hearing from you about suggestions for guests or questions that you might have, which I answer on Leo Laporte's The Tech Guy Show, Saturdays at 11:30. On live.twit.tv. That's 11:30 Pacific time. So next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Mark Waldrop, the CEO, president, founder, and chief engineer at AIX Records. And he's a big proponent of high fidelity, high resolution audio and multi-channel audio. So we're going to get pretty deep into that next week. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.